distribution of the nature-given factors of production, and secondly, the recognition of the fact that work performed under the division of labor is more productive than work performed in self-sufficient isolation. Now, several points are worth emphasizing here in order to reach a proper understanding of this fundamental insight of Mises into the nature of society, and those will be points which will also then help us realize some first preliminary conclusions regarding the role of sex, race, and crime in social evolution. First, it is important to recognize that inequalities with respect to labor or man and or land are a necessary but by no means a sufficient condition for the emergence of human cooperation. If all humans were identical and everyone were equipped with identical natural resources, everyone would produce the same qualities and quantities of goods, and hence the idea of exchange and cooperation would never enter anyone's mind. But the existence of inequalities is then not sufficient. There are obviously also differences in sex and differences in race in the animal kingdom, for instance. Nonetheless, we do not have in the animal kingdom anything like human cooperation. Besides diversity of man and nature-given resources, and a second requirement must be fulfilled if human cooperation is to evolve. Men, and at least two of them, must be capable of recognizing the higher productivity of a division of labor based on the mutual recognition of private property as compared to self-sufficient isolation or aggression, depredation, and domination. That is, there must be a minimum of intelligence or rationality, and men, or at least two of them at least, must have the will, that is, sufficient moral strength to act on this insight and be willing to forego some possible immediate gratification for some even greater future satisfaction. Mises writes, "But for intelligence and conscious will, men would have forever remained deadly foes of one another, irreconcilable rivals in their endeavors to secure a portion of the scarce supply of means of sustenance provided by nature. Each man would have been forced to view each other as his enemies. His craving for the satisfaction of his own appetites would have brought them into an implacable conflict with all his neighbors. No sympathy could possibly have developed under such a state of affairs." Now, members of the human race who are completely unable of understanding the higher productivity of labor performed under division of labor based on private property are, properly speaking, not persons at all, but they fall instead in the same moral category as animals of either the harmless sort, which can be domesticated, employed as a producer or a consumer good, or enjoyed as a free good. Or, of course, of the wild and dangerous kind that must be fought like the pest. And those members of the human species, on the other hand, who are capable of understanding this insight, but who lack the will or the moral strength to act accordingly, although these people would be considered persons, are either harmless brutes living outside of and separated from human society, or else they are more or less dangerous criminals that need to be punished. Now, human cooperation or society can only persist and advance as long as man is capable of subduing, taming, appropriating, and cultivating his physical and animalistic surroundings, and as long as he succeeds to suppress crime, that is, to reduce it to a relatively rare event by means of self-defense, property protection, and punishment. As soon as these requirements are fulfilled, however, and as long as man is engaged in cooperation, the natural forces of attraction arising from the differences in the sexes and the natural forces of repulsion or enmity arising from differences between the races or even differences within the races, they can be transformed into genuinely social relations. Sexual attraction can be transformed from copulation to consensual relations, mutual bonds, households, families, and love and affection. And intra or interracial repulsion can be transformed from feelings of enmity or hostility to a preference of cooperating and trading with one another only indirectly, that is, from a distance, from afar and physically separated and spatially segregated, rather than directly as neighbors and associates. Now, human cooperation, that is, division of labor based on the one hand on integrated family households, and on the other one, on separated households, villages, tribes, nations, races, and so on, wherein man's natural biological attractions and repulsions for and against one another are transformed into a mutually recognized system of spatial geographical allocation and of physical approximation and integration, or of physical separation and segregation and of direct or indirect contract, leads to generally improved future standards of living, a growing population, further extensification and intensification of the division of labor, and increasing genetic diversity and differentiation, and so on. And as a result of this development and an ever more rapid increase of goods and desires which can be acquired and satisfied only indirectly, professional traders and merchants and trading centers, that is, towns and cities, will emerge. Merchants and cities function as the mediators of indirect exchanges between territorially separated households, and thus become the sociological and geographical locus and focus of intertribal and interracial association. It will be within the class of merchants where racially, ethnically, or tribally mixed marriages are relatively most common, and because most people of both reference groups, different tribes, generally disapprove of such alliances, it will be in particular the wealthier members of the merchant class who can afford such extravagances, that is, the extravagance of getting married to people from different races. Even if the members of the wealthiest merchant families, however, will have to be cautious in such endeavors. In order not to endanger their own position as a merchant, great care must be taken that every mixed marriage is, or at least appears to the relevant ethnicities, as a marriage between equals, a marriage between peers. Except for the factor of race or ethnicity, the choice must appear extremely selective and evenly matched. Thus, the racial assimilation brought on by the merchant class will more likely than not contribute to genetic luxuration rather than genetic pauperization. And it will be in the big cities, as the centers of international trade and commerce, where the mixed couples and their offspring typically reside, and where members of different ethnicities, tribes, races, and so on, even if they do not intermarry, must still come into regular, direct, personal contact with each other, whereas a most elaborate and highly developed system of physical and functional integration and segregation will come into existence. And it is then also in the big cities where, as a subjective reflection of this complex system of spatial and functional allocation, citizens will develop the most highly refined forms of personal and professional conduct, manner, etiquette, and style. It is the city that actually breeds civilization and civilized life. Now I will say a few words about the origin of government and how all of this gradually changes. To maintain law and order within a big city, with its intricate pattern of physical and functional integration and separation, besides self-defense and private protection, a great variety of jurisdictions, of judges, enforcement agencies, and arbitrators will come into existence. There exists what one might call governance in a city, but there is no government, no state. For a government to arise, it is necessary that one of these many judges, enforcement agencies, and arbitrators succeeds in establishing himself as a monopolist. That is, he must be able to insist that no citizen can choose anyone but him as a judge or arbitrator of last resort. More interesting than the definitional question of what a government is, however, is then the immediately following question, that is, how is it possible that one judge can acquire a judicial monopoly given that other judges would naturally oppose any such attempt? Now, first off, almost by definition, it follows that inter-ethnic or tribal and racial tensions will be increased as soon as there exists a monopolist, because the monopolist, whoever he is, must be of one ethnic background rather than another one. And hence, he being the monopolist must then be considered by the citizens of other ethnic backgrounds as an insult and as a setback, as an act of arbitrary discrimination against people of one's own tribe, race, and so on. Accordingly, the delicate balance of peaceful inter-ethnic and interracial cooperation achieved through an intricate system of spatial and functional integration or association, and of course also separation and desegregation, will be upset. Secondly, this insight then also leads directly to the answer as to how one judge can possibly outmaneuver all others. In brief, to overcome the resistance by other judges, by competing judges, the aspiring monopolist must shore up added support in public opinion. And in an ethnically, tribally mixed milieu, this typically means that he has to play the race card. The prospective monopolist must incite the tribal and racial consciousness and awareness among citizens of his own race, tribe, and so on, and promise, in return for their support, to be a more than impartial judge in matters relating to one's own race or tribe. That is, he must promise to do precisely that, what the citizens of all other ethnic backgrounds are afraid of, that is, of being treated with less than impartiality. Now, at this stage of my reconstruction, let me, without further explanation, take a few quick additional steps to arrive at a realistic, more contemporary scenario regarding state, race, sex, and crime. Naturally, a monopolist will try to maintain his position and possibly even turn it into an hereditary title, that is, become a king. Yet to accomplish this within an ethnically, tribally mixed society, like a city, is a very, very difficult task, far more difficult than to do this in a completely homogeneous society. Instead, then, in big cities, with mixed populations, governments are far more likely to take on the form of a democratic republic with open entry into the position of supreme ruler, competing political parties and popular elections. And in the course of the process of political centralization, that is, the territorial expansion of one government at the expense of another, this big city model of government, the democratic republic, then will essentially become the only form of government, that is, of a democratic state exercising a judicial monopoly over a territory with ethnically, tribally, racially, widely diverse populations. Now, while the judicial monopoly of governments extends now typically far beyond a single city and in some cases over almost an entire continent, the consequences of government, this is the consequences of a judicial monopoly for the relations between the races and the sexes and the spatial approximation and spatial segregation can still be best observed in big, great cities and in their development from centers of civilization to centers of crime and decay. With a central government extending over cities and countryside as a first result, countries are created, and with countries being created, of course, also inlanders and foreigners. This has no immediate effect on the countryside, where there are no foreigners, that is, no members of different ethnicities or races. But in the great trading centers, where there are mixed populations, the legal distinction between inlanders and foreigners, rather than ethnically, racially distinct private property owners, must almost invariably lead to some form of forced exclusion and a reduced level of intertribal cooperation. Moreover, with a central state in place, the physical segregation and separation of city and countryside will be systematically reduced. Because in order to exercise its judicial monopoly, the central government must be able to access every inlander's private property. And to do so, it must take control of all existing roads and even expand the existing system of roadways. Different households and villages are thus brought into closer contact than they would have preferred if the choice would have been left with them. And in particular, the physical distance and separation of city and countryside will be significantly diminished, and thus internally forced integration will be promoted. Now, naturally, this tendency towards forced integration due to the monopolization of roads and streets will be most pronounced in the cities. And this tendency will be even further stimulated if, as it is typical, the government takes its seat in a city. For a popularly elected government cannot but use its judicial monopoly to engage in redistributive policies in favor of its ethnic, racial, and so on constituency, which will invariably attract even more tribe members from the countryside, and with changes in government, of course, more members of even more and different tribes to come from the countryside to the capital city to receive either government jobs or handouts. And as a result, not only will the capital become relatively oversized at the expense of other cities, at the same time, due to the monopolization of public streets, whereon everyone may proceed wherever he wants, all forms of ethnic, tribal, or racial tensions and animosities will be stimulated. Moreover, while interracial marriages were originally formally rare and restricted to the upper strata of the merchant class, with the arrival of bureaucrats and bums from various ethnic, tribal, racial backgrounds in the capital city, the frequency of intertribal and interracial marriage will increase, and the focus of interracial sex, even if not interracial marriage, will increasingly shift from the upper class of merchants to the lower classes and even to the lowest class of welfare recipients or bums. Rather than genetic luxuration, the consequence is increasing genetic pauperization. That is a tendency still more furthered by the fact that government welfare support, and the more so, of course, the more generous the support is, this government welfare support will naturally lead to an increase in the birth rate of welfare recipients relative to the birth rate of other members, and in particular of members of the upper class of various tribes and races. And as a result of this overproportional growth of low or even underclass people and an increasing number of ethnically, tribally, racially mixed offspring, especially in the lower and lowest social strata, the character of democratic popular government will gradually change as well. Rather than the race card being essentially the only instrument of politics, politics becomes now increasingly also class politics. The government rulers can and will no longer rely exclusively on their ethnic, tribal, or racial appeal and support, but increasingly they must try to find support also across tribal, racial lines by appealing to the universal, that is, not tribal or race-specific feeling of envy and egalitarianism, that is, to social class. And they have to play now the untouchables or the slaves against the masters, the workers versus the capitalists, the poor versus the rich, and so on. Now, the increasing admixture of egalitarian class politics to the pre-existing tribal policies leads to even more racial and social tension and hostility, and an even greater proliferation of the low and underclass population. Besides certain ethnic or tribal groups being driven out of the cities as a result of tribal policies, now increasingly also members of the upper classes of all ethnic and tribal groups will leave the cities for the suburbs. With the upper class and the merchants leaving in ever larger numbers the cities, however, one of the last remaining civilizing forces will be continuously weakened, and what is left behind in the cities then represents an increasingly negative selection of the population. On the one hand, government bureaucrats who work but no longer live in the cities, and of the low lives and the social outcasts of all tribes and races who live in the cities, yet who increasingly do not work but live on welfare. Just think of Washington, D.C. Now, when one would think that matters cannot possibly become worse, they will. After the race and the class card have been played out and done their devastating work, the government will turn next to the sex and gender card. And racial justice and social justice will be complemented by gender justice. The establishment of a government, and that is a judicial monopoly, not only implies that formally separated jurisdictions, as within ethnically, racially segregated districts, for instance, that those will be forcibly integrated, it implies at the same time that formally fully integrated jurisdictions, as within households and families, will be forcibly broken down or even dissolved. Rather than regarding intra-family or household matters, including even such serious subjects as abortion, for instance, as no one else's business to be judged and arbitrated solely within the family by the head of the household or the family, once a judicial monopoly has been established, its agents, the government, have also become and will naturally strive to expand their role as judge and arbitrator of last resort in all family matters. To gain popular support for this role, the government, besides playing one tribe or race or one social class against each other, will likewise promote divisiveness within the family, between the sexes, between husbands and wives, and between generations within a family, between parents and children. And once again, this will be particularly pronounced and visible, of course, in big cities. Every form of government welfare, that is the compulsory wealth and income transfer from some haves to some other have-nots, lowers the value of a person's membership in an extended family household system as a social system of mutual cooperation and help and assistance. Marriage accordingly loses in value. For parents, the value and the importance of a right upbringing or education of their own children will be reduced, and correspondingly, for children, less value will be attached and less respect will be paid to their own parents. Owing to the high concentration of welfare recipients in the big cities, family disintegration then is already well advanced at these places, but in now appealing also to gender and generation as a source of political support and promoting and enacting sex or gender and family legislation, invariably the authority of heads of families and households and the natural intergenerational hierarchy within families will be weakened, and the value of a multi-generational family as a basic unit of human society will be diminished. In fact, as should have been clear, but has been rarely noticed, as soon as government law and legislation supersedes and overrides family law and family legislation, that includes inter-family arrangements in conjunction with marriages, joint family offspring, inheritance, and so on, as soon as this task is taken out of the hands of families and the government becomes the last arbitrator, the value and importance of the institution of a family cannot but be systematically and increasingly eroded. For what is a family for if it cannot even find and provide for its own internal law and order? Now, accordingly, as government family policy increases, divorce, singledom, single parenting, and illegitimacy, incidents of parent, spouse, child neglect or abuse, and the variety and frequency of non-traditional lifestyles, homosexuality, lesbianism, communism, occultism, all of these things will increase. Lastly, parallel to this development, will be a gradual but steady upsurge of crime and criminal behavior. Under monopolistic auspices, law will be invariably transformed into legislation. As a result of an unending process of income and wealth redistribution in the name of racial, social, and/or gender justice, the very idea of justice as of universal and immutable principles of conduct and cooperation will be eroded and ultimately destroyed. Rather than being conceived of as something pre-existing and to be discovered, law is increasingly considered as government-made law or as legislation. And accordingly, not only will legal uncertainty then increase, and in reaction to this higher legal uncertainty, the social rate of time preference will rise. That is, people in general will become more present-oriented and have an increasingly shorter planning horizon. In particular, moral relativism will be spread and promoted, because if there is no such thing as an ultimate right, then by implication, there is also no such thing as an ultimate wrong. In fact, what is right today may be wrong tomorrow, and vice versa. Rising time preferences combined with moral relativism, however, provide the perfect breeding ground for criminals and crimes. That is a tendency especially noticeable once again in the big cities, for it is here where the dissolution of families is most advanced, where there exists the greatest concentration of welfare recipients and bums, where the process of genetic pauperization has progressed furthest, and where tribal and racial tensions as the outcome of forced integration are most virulent. Rather than centers of civilization, cities become centers of social disintegration, cesspools of physical and moral decay and corruption, brutishness and crime. The question then remains, is there anything that can be done? It will be very difficult, and I will talk about issues relating to this tomorrow in my speech. Thank you.